My name is Jeff DeBelko. I direct the Environmental Change and Security Program here at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C.
Well, you've written a lot about environmental peacemaking. Tell us what role water plays in either environmental peacemaking or even environmental conflict.
Well, we typically think of water and conflict, and in many ways it makes sense. Environmental management in many respects is conflict management. It's just that it often doesn't become violent, right? In the case of water, we obviously see lots of tension around water, but we don't really see the evidence for all the water wars that so many politicians and so many newspaper headlines scream about. What we often see is that while it is, and perhaps because it is such a critical resource between societies, between groups, between communities, between countries, that we find ways to at least cooperate and not make that the focus of conflict. So, for example, between the Jordanians and the Israelis, for decades of formal war, those two countries with water, hydrologists, the bureaucrats that had to manage these resources came together literally at a picnic table at the border for what became known as the picnic table talks to jointly manage water when their two countries were formally at war. Similarly, in India and Pakistan on the Indus River, these are dialogues that continue to go on where if it's not formal and active and proactive cooperation, there's at least a willingness to keep this issue off from the table in formally fighting over the conflict.
So some people have put Darfur on that map of resource conflict and even water-driven conflict. Mm-hmm. Can you put that in context?
I think it is important for us to remember in all conflicts there are many causes. Some are underlying and kind of foundational, and some are the proximate and most obvious. And in many times you have conflict entrepreneurs exploiting some of these underlying causes for their own purposes. So in the case of Darfur, you absolutely must start with the conflict entrepreneurs in Khartoum who are pitting one group that makes its living as pastoralist and one that makes it as agriculturist. They happen to coincide with ethnic groups and different backgrounds. And they're using that for their own purposes in terms of generating conflict between those groups. There have always been conflicts between pastoralists and agriculturalists in what is now Sudan and across sub-Saharan Africa. What is now severely testing the conflict resolution mechanisms are, on the one hand, those folks who are using this and exploiting these differences and really perpetrating a genocide in the region. But the other is that they are facing decades of intense drought periods, a combination of growth of both people but also cattle, tremendous growth in the last 50 years in the number of cattle that this arid area and more arid, and including even losing land area through desertification, is expected to sustain. So while one cannot tell the story, and one should start the story of Darfur about how the Janjaweed and the regime in Khartoum is perpetrating this genocide, one can't tell the story without understanding these larger underlying environmental conditions that are integrally related to water availability.
So let's take a look at an area of, again, intense political discussion, and that would be the Tibetan Plateau. Mm-hmm. It's strategically important for its supply of water. More than 10 major rivers draw their supply of water from the Tibetan Plateau. Talk a little bit about the geopolitical positioning of that geographic region.
Well, there are so many countries and so many, literally, you know, well over a billion, if not close to 2 billion people who are dependent on this water coming, originating in the Tibetan Plateau. And so by definition, that makes it high politics and critically important for the countries in a political strategic sense. But also the everyday livelihoods of literally billions of people who, particularly because that area is characterized by widespread poverty, really are living at the margins. And so this is a critical input into their daily lives, one that has challenges in terms of quantity and timing. in terms of flooding, particularly being a terrible problem there. And so issues of upland deforestation having very negative effects across borders for populations downstream. But then also, of course, quality. And as you well know, with however you count it, 2 to 5 million people dying yearly from dirty water or and associated diseases, this is high politics for those who are having to depend on those water sources. So it's both high politics at the individual level and it's high politics between the countries because of the interdependencies around the water, so much of which originates in the Tibetan Plateau.
China has a history in its bureaucracy of hydrologists. China is famous for engineering its water supplies. How do you think that plays into the future for China's water and even that region's water?
Water in China, like in all countries, is critical to development. And with economic growth being the premier goal of the government a lot of right reasons, and then that has implications that are challenges both for China itself and for its neighbors. Engineering and the natural and physical science has a long tradition and many, many distinguished Chinese scientists and engineers. It also so happens that in that country, the engineers and scientists are often very active politically as well. And so we do find, as opposed to, say, the United States, where I'm not sure that we've ever had an engineer as president, that the senior leadership in China has often been drawn from this disciplinary background. And so in China and also in India, where most of the world's remaining large dams are still being built, you have a political leadership that understands how to do it, that gains prestige and power from large projects such as dam building, and they see the need from an economic perspective. So whether it's for developing energy resources, which is a tremendous enabler but also constraint on the economic growth goal, for trying to control flooding, and also the prestige factor of these large dams. It's something that comes together to be an enabling environment for these large-scale projects. Now, much of the world has moved away from large-scale dams, in part because most of the opportune places to build them have been built, also because the social costs associated with it and the health costs associated with large dams suggest that in many cases the costs may outweigh the benefits, or at least there are some very specific trade-offs. In China, that set of trade-offs has not weighed as heavily on the decision-makers, and so you still see large dams being built. And I think we are in a position to see some challenges with countries, downstream countries from China, because so much of the world's rivers in that part of the world anyway originate in China. They obviously have big downstream impacts. And so what will be critical are having avenues and institutions to manage water across borders. And that has not always been easy. There are certainly successes, but it is, if we're looking out into the future as to what's going to be a way that water presents geostrategic challenges in Asia, it will be around transboundary water cooperation, much of that water originating in the rising China.
Now, much of this issue, to my surprise, has really been in the Tibetan Plateau, the water source. It hasn't really been discussed much. Right now, Tibet is in the news because of, again, the mm-hmm. historical, political challenges. But the water issue, the resource issue, really hasn't risen to the top. They're obviously very, very cognizant of what they have and what they need, mm-hmm. and even the threats, just the climate change threats on those future supplies.
Well, I think water is seen as a strategic asset for China, wherever it occurs in China, because so much of the water for China and the region originates in Tibet, it adds an additional level of importance, political sensitivity, and context that does not get the attention that it perhaps deserves. And in part from an optimistic spin, because we've seen evidence of other parts of the world in highly contested areas find ways to not just successfully manage water without coming to blows, but to actually use dialogue around water as a lifeline for dialogue when things are bad in other issue areas. And so one might try to pursue proactively opportunities for dialogue between groups that are having a hard time agreeing in other issue areas. And so one sees that in other parts of the world, and there are perhaps some models that we can, as we try to move beyond the heated rhetoric of the headlines and try to start walking back into more, at least dialogue as a start, and in hopes of providing some avenues for more cooperation and peaceful setting.
And looking to the future, this area is going to be even more challenged. Even the World Water Assessment Report indicates that the river flows could decline severely within less than 100 years. How do you see that shaping this transboundary region that's so highly populated?
Climate change is a real wild card when it comes to water. It is, in many respects, the biggest challenge to the notion that we don't fight wars over water, in the sense that will the future look like the past? We haven't done it in the past, but doesn't necessarily mean we won't in the future. And in part, the real nonlinear trajectories that are a good possibility because of climate change in the area of water raise real concerns. And so it could severely test our institutional ability to manage water across borders, and will present us with some realities that we haven't had to face before, and most importantly, at a pace and a rate of change that we haven't had to before. So dry places in the world that have been dry for a long time, while we might just rely on water per capita as, well, if where it's most scarce, we're most likely to see conflict. In fact, that's not the case. It's where there's the most rapid change. So we don't have ways to adapt politically, socially, economically to that change, where we see the most disruption. So part of what is so challenging about climate change is the rapid rate of change that's expected in terms of precipitation patterns, in terms of water availability from glacial melt, that really poses some fundamental challenges to whether the future will look like the past.
And this is, we're talking about the source of water for potentially billions of people here. Are other people having this epiphany, or are we just alone looking at the map and seeing here the potentials for hot zones?
Yeah. I think water is a tremendous challenge because it is so integral to different parts of our lives in ways that we have taken for granted, that doesn't necessarily become explicit in framing an issue as an issue of water itself. But of course, now food security. Well, of course, food is all about water. Agriculture, talking about industry. Well, we have big parts in China where the water is not even at a high enough quality for industrial purposes, let alone household and drinking purposes. So it's a constraint on industry. Certainly, it's a constraint vis-a-vis desertification and falling water tables. And the prospects for economic growth and human settlements in some sort of sustainable fashion in big parts of the world. And so I think it is, by being so ubiquitous, it also doesn't necessarily allow us to see it for the crisis that can be right there, because it is so integral. It does also then lead to a notion of one throws up one's hands because it is so complex, interlinked, and difficult to tackle. We ignore it at our peril, and to me it suggests that in a region such as Asia, that it behooves us now to invest in developing institutions for finding ways to cooperate around water, particularly under situations of great stress and great change, because once those stresses come, it will be in a crisis mode and reaction rather than proactive anticipation and trying to manage it in ways that allow us to try to adapt.
And these are areas that are have long histories of conflict.
Yeah, no, indeed. These are regions that don't need another reason to fight. And hopefully water won't offer that. Hopefully it'll offer exactly the opposite, a bridge of common interdependency that requires cooperation, and perhaps even levels of playing field that might in other areas be more unequal, and forces some of the more powerful countries to come to the table and find ways to cooperate because of the interdependence. There are no guarantees in that regard, but I think what we are guaranteed to see is water rising in importance, going from management issue that may be assigned just to technocrats to one that our highest levels of government will see as critical frontline top priority issues. I think that while the international components of water both present threat and opportunity, it's always a wonder that we can't capture more momentum and more importance from our political institutions around the notion of easily preventable mortality associated with dirty water. We spend a lot of money to hedge our bets in terms of security vis-a-vis what are very real threats and very existential threats. But if we want to save lives, then for pennies on the dollar, for interventions and technologies that we already have, we don't need to invent new ones in many respects, we really could be making a difference in a human security term that would be remarkable in terms of saving lives. And so I keep thinking that that water and health avenue is a way that we can find greater understanding and common purpose across countries, across groups, because that interdependency allows us to share a common interest in our children surviving, because, of course, it's the children who are the ones that are dying of diarrhea. And that, to me, offers some additional hope that around those issues we can rally and overcome the challenges that are come in a more water-scarce world.
A lot of people see China, probably rightly so, as an economic juggernaut, mm-hmm. and very, very controlling. You know, you read that there is fear that China will take a very controlling, non-cooperative attitude mm-hmm. with its water. Mm-hmm. Would it be even politically possible for them to do that?
I think because they are upstream and often economically and politically hegemonic, there's the most powerful in the region, there are precious few constraints on behavior that may be present in other parts of the world. I think there will be, in some ways, pressures to control excesses that come from within China, from within the populace. And so you see water in some sense being a high politics issue in China now from it being the source of political protests against factories that are being sited in areas that then produce waste in the water that make populations sick, and illegal land takings for those same factories. And so the social unrest that China has in recent years faced from kind of spontaneous or at least somewhat surprising protests when coupled with technology of SMS and cell phones, and suddenly 10,000 people show up the next day and the state doesn't realize they're about to come protest a plan, then that is going to hopefully find ways to put a brakes on some of the worst excesses around particularly pollution of water, but particularly also perhaps dams and relocations of people. It certainly cannot be relied upon to solve cross-boundary issues necessarily, but nevertheless maybe a break on the kind of unregulated exploitation of water that's going to have negative both quality and quantity implications.
It'd be interesting if the Dalai Lama brought up in their possible meeting coming up, if the Dalai Lama brought up water.
Yeah, I mean, I they have a full agenda, let's just say, and hopefully water is a point that both sides of that conflict can recognize as important and use as a bridge rather than a point of division.